No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype us at BBS Radio 1. That's BBS RadioOne. Today, we have a very interesting guest. I hope she hasn't arrived yet. She's a little late, but we're trying to get her right now. Her name is Shirley Tabb. Shirley is a social worker specializing in geriatrics. She's a graduate of the George Washington University Master's Scholar Program and holds a master's degree in social work from the University of Arkansas. She's been a social worker, case manager, and award-winning independent producer of cable TV. So today we're going to talk about end-of-life care, nursing homes and hospice, and public policies associated with these issues, assuming that we find Shirley wherever she is. So please call in with your comments and questions and be part of the conversation. Again, the number is 888-627-6008, or you can Skype us. My co-host, Maria, is not with us tonight. She's currently on travel and will return after the holidays. So let's get started. Big news on the statehood front. We got a new co-sponsor in the United States Senate. Tim Kaine, the senator from Virginia, is our newest sponsor in the U.S. Senate of the new Columbia Admission Act. This is a big deal, not only because we have gotten Senator Kaine from Virginia, which is one of our neighboring states, to be a co-sponsor, but we have both Maryland senators as well, Mikulski and Cardin. I see that Shirley's with us, so we'll get her on in just a minute. But that's the big news on statehood. Also, I'd like to take a moment of personal privilege and offer my condolences to my former employer, President Jimmy Carter. President Carter, who announced last week that he had beaten cancer at the age of 91, announced this morning, unfortunately, that his grandson, Jeremy, died suddenly of unknown causes. Jeremy was only 28 years old, so our condolences go out to President Carter and his family. As I was saying earlier, the big news in D.C. statehood is that we got a Virginia senator, Tim Kaine, as a co-sponsor. We have both Maryland senators, and now we've got to work on my former colleague, Mark Warner. Mark Warner is the other senator from Virginia, also a Democrat. We used to work together, and the reason that it's so important to have the Maryland and Virginia senators support us is because for many years, people thought that the people of Maryland and Virginia really wouldn't be for D.C. statehood. But that's not true, obviously, because we have 75% of their Senate delegation on our side. So that's great news. Shirley, are you with us?
I'm back.
Okay, you're back. And and this time we're going to keep you. We're not going to let you go.
Great.
But anyway, as we were saying, Shirley, the issues that you deal with are issues that people don't like to talk about, but they're very important issues, and they're becoming more and more important as baby boomers age in record numbers, and they really are issues that we have to deal with. So tell me, Shirley, what's the number one issue for you?
I think, Senator Brown, the number one issue for me is hospice and end-of-life care issues and opportunities. And it all kind of fits in with, as you said, elder care, caregiving and support as baby boomers, as we are getting older now, and certainly as we are working as caregivers with our parents and other people, relatives and friends, this need to have that conversation or that talk is becoming more and more important now, and most people don't like to talk about it. And when you and I were talking the other day, and you mentioned what you had gone through, you told a wonderful story, a very touching story about your sister. And I mean, it just really drove my point home, which is why I want to do this, to try to change the community's perception of this. We plan for everything. We plan for retirement. We plan for weddings. We save to buy a house and all these things, all these other significant events along the lifespan, but we don't plan for the inevitable. If I'm saving my money to buy this wedding dress, that may or may not happen. Or if I'm saving to retire, that may or may not happen, because I could die before retirement. But one thing for sure, we know that we will be faced with death, either ours first or somebody we love. So, but nobody wants to think productively and proactively and plan for what we know is going to happen.
Right. And that's a very important point. And just since you brought it up, let me just talk for a minute about my experience with my sister. And it's very, very important what you just said, Shirley, because my sister passed away at 45 years old. And this was very unexpected. Mm. You know, when you have a parent or a sibling that's in their 80s or 90s, you may prepare yourself for it. But when somebody goes suddenly 45 years old, 44, 45 years old, you're really not ready for it. And hospice is something that I knew nothing about. Mm. I knew nothing about it. And I was with my sister in the hospital, and they told my sister that her situation was terminal, and my sister asked me to take her home. Now, my sister had raised me from a child, because I was raised by a single mother who passed away when I was 15, and my sister kind of took over my life. She'd done so much for me that when she asked me to take her home, I went to the hospital and said, "How can I take her home?" And actually, the people in the hospital said, "You can't take her home. She's too sick. She needs to be in the hospital." And I said to them, "I have no choice but to take her home, because this is what she's requested of me, and my sister has never made a request of me. So there's no possible way that I can ignore her wishes. I really want to take her home." And they said, "Okay, if you're going to do this, you need to put her in hospice." And we got hospice care from a local hospital. It was just an amazing experience. It was an amazing experience. I spent the last 2.5 months of my sister's life with her. It gave us a chance to say goodbye to each other. It gave us a chance to work on any unresolved issues that we had. And it was the kindest and gentlest way to deal with her. And in the end, very unexpectedly for me, it was the kindest and gentlest way for me to deal with the problem as well. When she left, I felt so much more resolved, I think, about everything than I would have otherwise felt. So hospice is a great thing, and we need to let more people know about it. What is it that we can do, Shirley, to improve hospice care or to make it a more acceptable thing or to get more people involved?
Well, I think, Senator, what we can do is just what we are doing now. Start talking about it and continue talking about it and come up with formats where people can come out and share. I have been to 3 or 4 meetings or gatherings, and they call them in this area death cafes, and which I have no problem with that name, but I think it scares a lot of people because some people just can't handle the word death. So, but people are calling the community piece, death cafe, death over dinner, death over drinks, and this kind of thing. So I'm trying to do it on a different scale. Then another group, they are calling it the conversation, which I think is a little more palatable for most people. And I certainly plan to get, hopefully I could come back on your show at another time and we talk about this again. I also plan to start doing another show, which I look forward to you joining me on Social Work Today on DCTV. I plan to produce more shows there. And it's interesting, I went to a funeral on Friday. And I always tell people say, well, I don't go to funerals. I don't do funerals. But I have no problem with going to funerals because I always come back with something that I got out of it. And as they say, funerals are not for the dead. They are for those of us left behind. So I was at this funeral, and the minister got up and getting ready to do the eulogy, and he told us about a time when he took a writing class. And the instructor said, okay, I want you to get out a sheet of paper, and I want you to write your obituary. And he said he thought the man had lost his mind. Why would you want me to write my obituary? And he said, well, this is a good way for you to be an active part in what you would want said. What do you think you would want said, or what do you think people would say about you at the time of your death? And I thought, wow, that was an aha moment for me, because I think I would like to get people to do that and then get them to thinking about, okay, if I wrote the obituary, now how about getting this out? So writing down where you can find my insurance policies, do you want a do not resuscitate, or do you want them to keep resuscitating you to see if they can keep you alive a little while longer, and talk with your family. So you write it down, then invite family over and share this information. So I'm looking for little bitty ways to put that out in the community without overwhelming people.
Well, you know, first of all, let me tell you that on 5 separate occasions, I have been asked to eulogize people. And you can imagine that these people were all very close to me.
Yes.
You know, it's a very, very difficult thing to do, to summarize somebody's life, summarize it in a few minutes.
Exactly.
And, you know, and for the people that are there, because you're right, it is absolutely for the people that have survived, you know, and you want to make sure that you're sensitive to that. And I've always done it because I consider it a great honor.
Yes.
I consider it a great honor for somebody to ask you to stand up there and talk about their loved ones.
Exactly.
And hold their hands. And I've learned something every time I've done it. But, you know, it's unusual that you should bring this up about the eulogizer at this funeral, because when I was in college, I had a professor that asked us to do a similar thing in writing our epitaph.
Yes.
He said, write your epitaph, what you would want those that come behind after you to see if they walked through a cemetery and saw your headstone.
Yes.
And some people did funny things, and some people did, you know, talked about what they we were in college, right? So what their aspirations were, you know, so somebody might write, you know, former Miss America, President of the United States, you know, whatever they had hoped to become.
Uh-huh.
And mine, he wrote on mine that mine was the most unusual. Because mine said thank you.
Oh, and, wow.
And I said, it really made me think, how would I summarize my life? And that was what I thought. I thought, life is such a gift.
It is.
There's so, you know, so many wonderful things and you know, certainly tragic things too, but there's so many wonderful things to think about in being alive and being part of this great universe, that's all I could think to say is thank you. Thank you for everything that I've been given. Thank you for the life I've been given and the advantages that I've been given and the disadvantages that I've been given, because they made me stronger. So it's something I thought about a long time ago, and I think that the whoever gave the eulogy, that was a brilliant thing to say. Write your own eulogy. I think we all should do that.
Exactly. And I think what you said about you would want to be your epitaph, I think that was just so wonderful and just so selfless. I mean, you were saying thanks for what I have been given. And I bet you wouldn't see many like that out in a cemetery, because most people, they don't think about the gratitude part.
Right.
We usually think about, well, what did the world do for me? It's not so much as giving back or acknowledging gratitude, which is so important in the way we live.
Right. That's absolutely right. And I just went to a funeral. I just went to a funeral of a man who was, I believe he was 88 years old, and his wife is a friend of mine, lovely lady, and what they did, because they had time to think about it and prepare for it, because he
that
was
makes the
this
difference.
Old. Yes, and they did a beautiful, beautiful thing at, it was all like a party at a music school that he had been involved in with for many years here in Washington, Levine School of Music. You probably know it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a celebration of his life.
Exactly.
And you know, I think that's what it should be.
I do too.
Yeah. And the way you get there is by facing that and dealing with those things. So what can we do? What can we do from a public policy standpoint? I know that you talked to me briefly. You mentioned the fact that a member of the city council, Council Member Che, has proposed some legislation. What is that legislation?
That's the Death with Dignity bill. And I certainly do support that bill, because you remember the young lady a few months back, Brittany Maynard, who moved to another state. I can't remember now where she was living, but she moved out west somewhere, one of those states where they give you what they call the right to die if you have, as was the case with your sister, if you received a terminal diagnosis, then they give you the respect of being fully involved in how you want your life to end. And that's what Council Member Che wants to do here in the district. And it was interesting, the day that they had those hearings, there were people, oh, I think they must have had well over 100 witnesses, and you had about half of the people were pro, half did not agree with it. But I think it was weighing more on more people who did agree with it. They had some people there who had some chronic illnesses who said, well, I know that this disease will kill me, and I know that as it progresses, it's not going to be pretty, it's not going to be pleasant for me, and I would want to determine whether or not I want to go through that kind of pain and all. And I certainly do agree with that, and I hope to help Council Member Che do everything she can so she can get that bill passed. And she's looking forward to coming on your show as well and talking about the bill once they get it through some of these other committees. But in terms of public policy, I was also reading where in one state, one of the officials was working with the community, his constituents, and really urging them to do their paperwork to get their wills together so that the family wouldn't get so stressed out when it come time to divide up what's left. And I just thought, wow, this guy really gets it, because he is stepping out there from the policy perspective and having people do this. And I would even like to try to get our officials here in the district and in other states to start thinking about that, because if we come at it from that angle, I think more people would embrace it. And then next, I would like to see us go into the churches and get the ministers behind this. My Lord, they certainly do enough eulogies and get involved in enough family disputes, whereas if this had been written down, put out in the family, knew what mama wanted, who mama wanted to get the fur coat and this and that, then it wouldn't be so many hurt feelings during a very difficult time in the life of a family. And then I would also, Senator Brown, like to see us start to go into high school and start teaching and talking with young people about death and dying, because I don't remember now. I think the first death I experienced was a neighbor, an elderly middle-aged lady, and I guess the reason I'm not squeamish or afraid of dead people, or I'm not afraid of dying, because they left this lady in the in the funeral home, and I guess that was during visitation. I must have been 10, 11 years old. And I went in there and I looked at the body, and I just looked at it. And I remember I felt her arm, and it was hard, and because people had talked about, well, how dead people are. And I think that's what kind of desensitized me. And I'm glad it did, because I have some colleagues who have very good educations, but they'll tell you in a minute, oh, I don't do funerals. It has to be mighty close to me before I'll go, which I respect that. But I don't feel that way. I just feel that if we start working with people when they are younger, and then when they do experience that, it won't be so traumatic for them.
Well, you know, I will tell you that, and you certainly know this, but this is something that you have to deal with. And sometimes the fact that we're not prepared to deal with it, I think, makes that so problematic. And again, I'll give you an example. When my mom passed away, I was 15 years old. Mm-hmm. And she had struggled for a long time with her illness. Mm-hmm. And they had canceled her hospitalization insurance. Mm. So when my mom died, she died very much in debt. And we didn't own a house. We didn't own a car. We didn't own anything. We were absolutely broke. In fact, we were destitute. But because we were children – my sister and my brother and I, when my mom died, she took the debt with her. Mm-hmm. So we were never poor. You know what I mean?
Right.
We were devastated and we were broke, but then she passed away and all that went away.
Yeah.
And we were on our own.
Yeah.
But with me, because I was 15 years old, people did everything they could to shield me from it.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't involve me in any of the funeral arrangements. They
mm-hmm.
did things to try to distract me. And you know what? They did that because they loved me.
Oh,
but
of course.
They were wrong about it.
Yeah.
They were wrong
yeah.
to do that.
They
because
were.
Later in life, I had to deal with all those feelings.
Exactly.
I had to deal with the fact that I felt guilty about the end of my mother's life, that I wasn't more sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I felt it for a long time until I started to meet friends of mine that had 15-year-old children, and I realized what a child I was myself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then I forgave myself for not being more sensitive. But, you know, if they had involved me more,
exactly.
I wouldn't have had to go through that. And
exactly.
and there's no way to avoid it. You know,
exactly.
you can put it off. You cannot talk about it. And, you know, a funny thing, till this day, because my sister was so important to me in my life, there were many people after my sister died that absolutely refused to talk about my sister because they assumed it made me sad.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not true. I love to talk about her
mm-hmm.
because it's the memory of her
exactly.
that keeps her alive in
exactly.
my life.
Exactly.
So, I think we come upon a lot of these misconceptions with the best intentions, you know.
We do.
And we all know that where good intentions get you sometimes, but
exactly.
I think we have good intentions, but we really do need to talk about this stuff.
We need to have that conversation.
Yes, we do, and we need to be prepared for it, and we need to understand it for what it is, and it's part of life.
It's death is just an extension of life. It's that next,
yes.
that final chapter, and we must prepare for it as we
yes.
do anything else. But so many people just don't. They just, I guess, they just think that they are going to live forever and ever, or else it's like sticking the ostrich, putting his head in the sand. If I bury my head in the sand, I won't have to deal with it. But you will need to deal with it.
Yes.
And in some communities, in terms of not being prepared, now that we have these GoFundMe campaigns, you hear people now when people die and they'll say, well, they have a GoFundMe campaign up for her. You can go to this website. But is that death with dignity when you must go around and pass a hat to be buried, whereas
yeah.
if you had already taken care of that, had a little policy, then the family could worry just about getting things together and making sure everything was in place instead of having to beg for a way to bury you or otherwise dispose of your remains?
Well, let me ask you, is there any way we can institutionalize this? Is there a way, have you thought about this? Is there a way to start an organization that people can go to for advice? Can I come to you for advice? Or is there another organization I can go to if I want advice on how to deal with these issues? And go ahead.
As a social worker, certainly you could come to somebody like me. It's just interesting, Senator Brown, in terms of how the universe routes our lives and reroutes us to where we are supposed to be. I have had the honor of working at a cemetery and also selling cemetery property. And I always tell people this is something that I would do without pay if I were a wealthy woman. And they say if you find something that you would do without pay, then you found your mission in life. And I enjoyed doing that so much because it was truly helping people. And I loved when I would go in to make a presentation to the husband and wife, and they would sit there over a cup of coffee and joke about, well, okay, if I was selling them side-by-side graves, and they would say, the wife might say, well, I want to be on the left side because this is the side of the bed I sleep on. And he would laugh lovingly, and they would sit there, and they would make those arrangements right then and there, which was the loving thing to do, so that woman wouldn't, whoever went first, wouldn't have to go out in that cemetery park on the most difficult day in their lives and pick a spot. So I just loved doing that. And then they had the little signs that you could, the little rings, the little everlasting interlocking rings, wedding rings. Some people would pick those, or they would get other symbols for the headstone or the grave marker. And I just thought that was so romantic. And another thing I thought about doing in terms of institutionalizing this is to try to find one of the local colleges and institute a class where we could start teaching concepts and principles of end-of-life care, and catch students there, people, and of course it could be an elective course, and see who would be interested in attending it. And then maybe you could start getting more people more oriented to this concept sooner than later.
Well, you know, it's that's kind of the thing I'm talking about for family members and people to deal with these issues, because I remember very distinctly from hospice that hospice was set up in a way that dealt very effectively with the issues. For example, there was a social worker who was a case manager, I guess, and she was involved in my life, and I talked to her every day of my life. During that period of time, she was like a lifeline. Yes. And the day my sister passed away, I could no longer get in touch with her. They immediately withdrew her because they understood that it was not healthy for me to have an attachment to her that went beyond this situation, right? It was time for me to have to deal with certain issues on my own. And they were there to support me through the funeral and everything,
right?
But not her. Other people.
Okay, yeah. Right. Well, I can understand that concept because
right. And you know, so there are certain ways to deal with this.
Oh, yeah.
Excuse me, that are much more effective than other ways.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it would seem to me that would be a good thing. And another thing that's always amazed me. Now, you talked about this earlier, who gets grandma's fur coat and who gets the grandfather clock and stuff. We worry about all those material things and we divide them up, but we don't really pass that which is most important in our lives on, which is part of ourselves. You know, I'd like to see people put together material, especially now that we can do all these videos and stuff, put together material so that when your children, if you're not there for your daughter's wedding, if you're not going to live that long, wouldn't it be nice to be able to give her something at that time in her life that explains to her how you feel? And how proud you are of her, and all the things that you would say if you had been there.
Exactly, you know, and I agree with that.
Yeah, if we could do things that are not just material, not just a material division of our wealth, but also pass on the wisdom and love and the other things that make us so individual and so special.
Exactly. That's excellent. And as a matter of fact, I know a lady who is a videographer and who has done some of that. She has captured some of that, those feelings and emotions and those gifts for elderly people. And I think she even interviewed some people in hospice, and I thought that was the most loving thing that they could have done, is to left something like that where that could last around for generations.
Right. Well, the reason that this came to mind, the reason I thought about it, is I read an article one day where Steven Spielberg had decided to do this big project of professional videography. Mm-hmm. Videography of people who had been through the Holocaust, because after he did Schindler's List, he realized that these people were dying. You know, that they were now in their 80s and 90s, and soon they would be gone, and there would be no witness to this terrible thing in our history, and what a loss that would be. So he gave a multi-million dollar grant to the Holocaust Museum, which is an organization that I've worked with, in order to do that, in order to bring in survivors from concentration camps and from that period in time, and to actually interview them so that future generations would have a firsthand account and would understand this terrible tragedy in human history from the perspective of the people who had actually lived it. And I thought, you know, that's just a brilliant idea, and we should probably all do it to a certain extent.
Exactly. So. I agree.
Let me ask you another question, Shirley. Sure. What about nursing homes? I had my aunt. I took care of an elderly aunt who was in what I consider to just be a wonderful, caring facility in Virginia. But I've got to tell you, even with people that care, nursing homes are not very nice.
Well,
it's a tough place. It's a tough place to be. And you see a lot of people there that, you know, that don't have very good quality of life. What can we do about that?
Well, we can certainly try and strengthen long-term care laws, and we can strengthen the budget for give you an example. Around the country, there is a program, if states choose to use it, and we do here in the District of Columbia, it's called the Medicaid Waiver for Home and Community-Based Services. Now, I worked in that program for 8 or 9 years and loved working in it because it waived the strict income requirements for Medicaid for people whose income was a little bit higher than the threshold for just basic Medicaid, and that's why they called it the waiver program. And these people were able to get home health care and stay home with home health care. And most people who are able to stay home, now there are some people, if you are on life support and some of these other modalities, then home health is not going to be appropriate. But for those people who are able to age in place and stay home, they tend to do better. Most people say, I want to die at home if I can. And that's one of the beauties of these Medicaid waiver programs. People are able to stay home. Now, where the government, I mean, in the district, is wonderful about this, but some jurisdictions don't quite put as much money into these programs. And without money, you don't have the number of hours that a person might need in order to remain at home. But it's an excellent system if you have access to it, and it can pay for people to be in your home up to 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So that's hard to beat, and I would choose that over the best nursing home, because people want to be around, surrounded by people they know and familiar things in their home. And with good care, they've proven that people who remain home and community-based tend to live longer.
Well, that's absolutely, I'm convinced that that's absolutely the truth. And the last place, and that was the thing about the nursing home, you know, is that I would go there to visit my aunt, and there'd be 30 people lined up in the hall in wheelchairs, just sitting there all day.
Yeah,
there's nothing else for them to do. And how depressing, you know, my first job out of college, it's funny. My first job out of college was working for a law firm where I went to Florida into elderly communities and did research for companies that wanted to start new savings and loans in the area. And I used to think to myself when I came home, I'd go into some of these communities, and sometimes I would interview people, and they would virtually kidnap me. They would bring me into the house, you know what I mean, and feed me and give me lemonade and cookies and show me pictures of all their grandchildren and stuff. And I would say to myself, I would come out thinking, wow, that's kind of sad. They're so lonely.
That's,
you know, I'm the first person under 80 years old that they've seen, you know, in 2 weeks. And, and you know, and they so want that interaction. And I thought to myself, I don't want to surround myself with nothing but old people when I get old. And I'm getting old very quickly, let me tell you. But, you know, I want a mix of young people and you know, I want things that are familiar. I want – so I absolutely believe what you say, that people that are in their home are not only better off and live longer, but it's better off for their family too.
Oh, it certainly is better off for their families. And as I said, I'm certainly not – we are not knocking nursing homes, because there is a need for them.
Yes,
because
there is.
Some people require that level of care. But for those people who do not require that level of care, home and community-based is absolutely the best, because if I'm left to age in place, jurisdictions, including the District of Columbia, has places, for instance, I own a senior services. They have places, they have a wonderful social program where seniors can come and they do arts and crafts and they study art, and people come in and entertain them. And we have the Hattie Holmes Health Center and various centers are like that around the district and in other jurisdictions, I'm sure. So people can go and be among other people and do activities and go shopping. They take them on shopping trips and stuff. So they just enjoy themselves. But if you are more confined, then that brings on depression, and your family is depressed because they are worried about you, and it can just get bad.
Well, you know, Iona is a perfect example, I think, that you've given, that Iona is in my neighborhood. They're directly across the street from a gigantic elementary school.
They sure are.
The kids are there. That's where my kids went to school.
Mm-hmm.
And Iona is, I was an ANC commissioner in the neighborhood, and we dealt with Iona all the time. And yeah, they have absolute great programs. There's a lot of community involvement
It certainly is. They are wonderful. And right next door is Friendship Terrace, which has wonderful programs for people in that retirement building. So the District of Columbia and out in Maryland, Prince George's County, Montgomery County, they also have good supports for seniors who are able to catch that little van and be transferred to these different places. But and there was a time, I believe it was at UDC, University of the District of Columbia, where they had a geriatric or the gerontology program, would send volunteers out to visit with seniors, because they recognized the need there for seniors to have people to come in and see them and just spend some time talking with them so they didn't get so lonely.
Well, that's the thing that I think it is a point that we really need to get across, that this isn't just doing something for seniors. It's doing something for the community. You know, when I was a youth group leader, I was a youth group leader at our church, and every Christmas, at Christmas time every year, we used to go to Friendship House, and we would take the kids, and the kids would sing Christmas carols. Now, we weren't a choir. We were just a bunch of people with a bunch of kids that would come, and they would dress up, and they would come. And let me tell you something. It did as much for the children as it did for the elderly people. They left. They brought so much joy into the lives of these people. They got so many hugs. They got so much that the kids came out of there feeling like they had really done something substantial and had done something that not only helped people, but really encapsulated the spirit of the season. And it was just an amazing experience for the children as well as the people that lived at Friendship House. So, you know, it's something that really is a community building thing. And that's
really
the thing.
Is.
We need to be one big community.
Exactly, exactly. And people, more people should do as you did with your children, as some other people do. Get the kids out and take them to visit nursing homes and senior centers so that can also show them that this is a wonderful way to give back to your community. And then you get something out of it, too, because you see the smiles on these people's faces. And that's good for the children.
Right. And children love to be accepted by adults. You know, we spend so much time outside of our families really ignoring kids. You know,
exactly.
We're in a hurry.
We sure do.
We put them in the school. We're off to work. You know, so for these older people who focus their attention on the kids for that little bit of time, it really makes the kids feel good. Well, Shirley, we got about 5 minutes left, and I got to tell you, I know that you're a lifelong Washingtonian, so I can't let you off the show without asking you a few questions about our disenfranchised status here in the district. Do you find it harder? Do you think it would be easier to work, do the kind of work you do in the District of Columbia if we had senators and representatives who could vote for the things that you care about?
I certainly do, but that is certainly a limitation for all of us when we don't have equal representation in the House or the Senate. When this is the nation's capital, I'm originally from Arkansas, but I've been here since about 92, and it just baffles my mind as to why we are treated that way, why we are dependent on the Congress to determine what our budget is going to be. They don't think our government officials can run local business, local government. I'm hoping in our lifetimes that this inequity will be resolved. But it's been going on for a long time. But I think I'm an optimist. I think that with people like you out there plugging for it and others, Senator Brown, I just believe it's not long coming.
Well, thanks for that, Shirley. And I don't think that I could have said it any better. And I just want you to know, on a personal note, that I went to the Ward 4 Christmas party last night, and I met a lady whose name escapes me right now, but she's a friend of yours, and she just went on and on about what a wonderful person you are. And I now, after talking to you for the last 55 minutes, realize how right she is. You are a wonderful person. And
thank you.
I hope. I think we've just scratched the surface here. I think there's so much more to talk about. So let me just ask you, have you lined up your show yet? Do you have a time? And
I don't remember the time. I know that my show starts on January the 10th, and I think it's 4 o'clock Eastern time, but I will certainly have that. Deborah and I will have all of that information out there on Facebook and other social media.
Well, and get the information to me as well,
okay,
and we'll announce it on the show, because think it's an important information to have, and I hope people will listen to your show.
I do too.
And I hope you will come back.
Oh, I will.
And talk, because you know, I can talk to ladies from Arkansas all day long.
Well,
you have that lovely little accent, and you're just a delight to talk to, and thank you so much for being on our show.
Oh, you're welcome.
And we hope
thank
to have
you.
You back soon.
I look forward to it, Senator.
And I wish you the happiest holiday season.
Oh, same to you and your audience.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Thanks, Shirley.
Okay.
Well, America, we're going to leave you now with a song by Stevie Wonder. It's really a hope for a better world. This is my Christmas wish for everybody out there. Next week on the 27th, we will do a repeat of an earlier show, and then I'll be back on January 3rd. So my tradition is a Christmas tradition, and I wish everybody a Merry Christmas or a Happy Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, whatever way you celebrate. I hope you celebrate with the people you love and that you appreciate all the gifts you've been given, and what a wonderful world with all its bumps and bruises that we live in. This is a farewell from me for the year from Stevie Wonder. Thanks. We'll see you on the 3rd.
Someday at Christmas, men won't be boys, playing with bombs like kids play with toys. One warm December, our hearts will see a world where men are free. Someday at Christmas, there'll be no war.
Representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.